There's a widespread perception that there's some kind of a conflict or contradiction between science and religion. Atheists confidently assert that there is. Many religious people fear that there is. And this has helped to undermine the faith of many. Now, certainly some religious beliefs do conflict with science. But why is there a perception that all religion per se, is contrary to science? I think people are mistaking one thing for another. There's a real long-standing and often bitter conflict going on, but it is not between religion and science. It is between religion and a certain philosophy called scientific materialism. Scientific materialism is an idea that grew up alongside of science. It was inspired by science and wraps itself in the mantle of science. It is, in fact, the worldview of many scientists and of some people who presume to speak for science. But it is not science. It is has no claim to be science. It's a philosophical idea. The central tenet of scientific materialism is very simple, and that is that the ultimate reality is matter, so that everything can be explained through the laws of physics and chance, sometimes called physicalism. Everything is physics. For some of its adherents, however, it's more than that. It's more than a philosophical stance. It's an anti-religious ideology. And it has a critique, a very well-developed critique of religion, that has three aspects: philosophical, historical, and scientific. So their philosophical claim is that there's an inherent contradiction between the scientific and religious outlooks. Science is based on reason and evidence, whereas religion, they say, is irrational because it is based on dogma, faith, and mystery, which involve belief in things that cannot be seen and for which, supposedly, there is no evidence. Science is based on natural explanations and natural laws, whereas religion is based on miracles and the supernatural. They see religion as a matter of myth and magic, and therefore pure superstition, which is the very antithesis of a rational scientific outlook. Their historical claim is that religious believers and institutions have been hostile to science and have tried to suppress it. This is powerfully symbolized for many people by the Catholic Church's treatment of Galileo and by the incessant battles against evolution waged by biblical literalists. Their scientific claim is that the actual discoveries of modern science over the last 400 years have debunked or undermined fundamental Christian beliefs about the universe and humanity's place in the universe. As the story is often told, science has dealt one blow after another to the religious conception of the world. Copernicus showed that man is not at the center of the universe. Newton showed that the world is governed by blind and impersonal forces. Modern astronomy showed how small and insignificant we are in the cosmic scheme. Darwin, they say, showed that we are differed from lower animals or other animals only in degree. Discoveries in fields such as neuroscience and artificial intelligence are expected to show, if they haven't already, that the supposed soul is just the working of the brain, a complex biochemical computer. And modern cosmology is invoked to show either that the universe had no beginning or that the universe created itself out of nothing by a quantum fluctuation. I'll deal with each of these three strands in turn. First, the philosophical. The philosophical critique is largely based on crude misunderstandings of traditional ideas about God and creation. Let's start with the idea of supernaturalism. Christianity and Judaism were never based on supernaturalism, if we mean by that a rejection of the idea that there's a natural order. Indeed, scholars tell us that the book of Genesis was in part a polemic against the supernaturalism and superstition of ancient pagan religions. When Genesis said that the sun and moon were merely lamps, set in the heavens by God to light the day and night. It was countering the paganism that worshipped the sun and moon. When it said that man is made in the image of God and is to exercise dominion over the animals, Genesis was, among other things, countering the paganism in which people worshipped and bowed down to animals, or to gods made in the image of animals. In paganism, the world was imbued with occult forces and populated by numerous deities, gods of the earth and ocean, goddesses of sex and fertility, and so forth. But Jews and Christians taught that there was only one God who was to be sought not within nature, not within its phenomena and forces, but outside of nature, a God who is indeed the author of nature. So biblical religion, by sharply distinguishing creator and the created world, desacralized and depersonalized the physical universe and made it indeed into a natural world, and thus helped to clear the ground for the later emergence of science. The biblical religions then taught that there is a natural order which comes from God. What characterizes this natural order and reflects the rationality of its creator is precisely that it is orderly, harmonious, and lawful. Consider this passage from the famous letter of Clement to the Corinthians, written about 97 AD. It's one of the, perhaps other than the Didache, the earliest Christian writing outside the New Testament that survives. So Clement writes, "The heavens, as they revolve beneath his government, do so in quiet submission to him. The day and night run the course he has laid down for them. Sun, moon, and the starry choirs roll on in harmony at his command, none swerving from his appointed orbit. Laws of the same kind sustain the fathomless deeps of the abyss and the untold regions of the netherworld. The impassable oceans and all the worlds that lie beyond it are themselves ruled by the like ordinances of the Lord. Upon all of these, the great architect and lord of the universe has enjoined peace and harmony." Or consider this passage from the Christian apologist Minucius Felix, writing around 200 AD. "If upon entering some home you saw that everything there was well tended, neat, and decorative, you would believe that some master was in charge of it, and that he was himself much superior to those good things. So too, in the home of this world, when you see providence, order, and law in the heavens and on earth, believe that there is a Lord and author of the universe more beautiful than the stars themselves and the various parts of the whole world." So it was not the supernatural or miraculous departures from the order of nature, but the order of nature itself and its lawfulness that was seen as pointing to its creator. The ancient argument was that if there is a law, there is a lawgiver. God was the lawgiver not only to Israel, but to the cosmos itself. In Jeremiah, the book of Jeremiah, God says, "When I have no covenant with day and night and have given no laws to heaven and earth, then too will I reject the descendants of Jacob and of my servant David." Psalm 148 tells of the sun, the moon, the stars, and the heavens obeying a divinely given law that will not pass away. The idea of God as rational lawgiver very likely helped give birth to modern science, or to the very concept of laws of nature, as even some atheists at times concede. For example, the eminent biologist E.O. Wilson suggested the following as the reason that Chinese civilization, for all its impressive achievements in science and technology, did not produce a Newton or a Descartes. He said, "Chinese scholars had abandoned the idea of a supreme being with personal and creative properties. No rational author of nature existed in their universe. Consequently, the objects they meticulously described did not follow universal principles. In the absence of a compelling need for the notion of general laws, thoughts in the mind of God, so to speak, little or no search was made for them." And the well-known cosmologist André Linde, who's an atheist, has suggested that the notion of a universe governed, quote, by a single law in all its parts is historically rooted in monotheism. Now, Christianity does, of course, teach that there are supernatural realities, such as divine grace, that have effects in the world. But the word supernatural, which means above the natural, would make no sense unless there were a natural order to begin with. And the concept of miracles, which are extraordinary events that go beyond what is naturally possible, presupposes that there is a natural order that determines what is naturally possible and what is not. There's no logical contradiction between the idea of miracles and the idea of a lawful universe, for the same lawgiver who established the laws of nature can also suspend them. There's much confusion today, even among some Christian believers, about how nature relates to God. Instead of seeing God as the author of nature, they see God and nature as somehow opposed or in competition. So if something has a natural explanation, then God had nothing to do with it. And conversely, if God is the cause of something, it must be supernatural. Many therefore look for evidence of God only in what is outside the course of nature and cannot or inexplicable by science, that is, to gaps in our scientific understanding, hence the expression the God of the gaps. And atheists think that by closing those gaps in our scientific understanding, they will leave no place for God to hide. The traditional Christian and Jewish view is quite different. If God, as creator of the natural world, established its laws and gave things their natural powers, then his existence is evident in nature itself and its ordinary processes, whose power and working reflect God's own power and wisdom. This is the message of the following passage from the Book of Wisdom, a Jewish work of about 100 BC, which is part of the Catholic Bible, or not an Orthodox Church's Bible, but not the Protestant Bible. This, by the way, is probably, I think, is the one passage in all of Scripture that is in a sense, addressed to scientists. It's chapter 13 of the Book of Wisdom. It's actually addressed to the ancient philosophers and physicoi of ancient Greece. For all people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature. They were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists. Nor did they recognize the artisan while paying heed to his works, but they supposed that either fire or wind or swift air or the circle of the stars or turbulent water or the luminaries of heaven were the gods that ruled the world. If through delight in the beauty of these things people assumed them to be gods, let them know how much better than these is their Lord, for the author of beauty created them. And if people were amazed at their power and working, let them perceive from them how much more powerful is the one who formed them. For from the greatness and beauty of created things comes a corresponding perception of their creator. Now notice that the evidence of God to which this passage points consists of phenomena that are perfectly natural. Fire, wind, swift air, the circle of the stars, turbulent water, and the luminaries of heaven, that is, the stars, planets, sun, and moon. Now, medieval theologians distinguish two ways in which God acts in the world. He can act directly in a supernatural manner, for example, turning water into wine, or he can accomplish his will through the operation of natural causes and processes. It has always been the Christian view that God ordinarily acts in the latter way. In the words of the 17th century Catholic theologian Suarez, God does not interfere directly with the natural order where secondary causes suffice to produce the intended effect. I'll explain the term secondary causes in a moment. Here it may be read as natural causes. God does not interfere directly with the natural order where natural causes suffice to produce the intended effect. This principle was important for the founding of science, for it implied that when confronted by some puzzling event or new phenomenon, we should look first for natural explanation. Superstitious people tend to see the supernatural in every unusual or strange event, but this was strongly criticized by the great medieval scientist theologian Nicole Oren. In explaining the marvels of nature, he said, quote, "There is no reason to take recourse to the heavens, or to demons, or to our glorious God, as if he would produce these effects directly, any more than he directly produces those effects whose natural causes we believe are well known to us." Another great medieval scientist and theologian, Jean Bouridon, said that when confronted by new phenomena, we should seek, quote, appropriate natural causes. That's why the Catholic Church, for example, does not declare a miracle to be worthy of belief until it has excluded the likelihood of natural explanations. This brings us to the all-important theological distinction between primary and secondary causality. I think it is the failure to grasp this distinction that is one of the main reasons that people see a conflict between science and religion. The distinction can be explained using a simple analogy. Consider the play Hamlet. In that play, the character Hamlet stabs the character Polonius through a curtain and killing him. Now let me ask you the following question. Did Polonius die in the play Hamlet because Hamlet stabbed him? Or did he die because Shakespeare wrote the play that way? Well, it's obviously a stupid question, because both. They're not contradictory. They're not in competition with each other as causes. The character Hamlet is the cause within the play of Polonius's death, what you might call the horizontal cause, or what theologians would call the secondary cause as applied to the universe. Whereas Shakespeare is the vertical cause, or the primary cause, of the whole play, of all its characters, of all its events, of all the causal relationships within the play. The entire plot, including Polonius' death. There's no competition or conflict between these two types of causality. By analogy, the natural causes within the universe, which are studied by scientists and other people, are horizontal or secondary causes, while God as the author of nature is the vertical or primary cause. The analogy makes clear just how silly it is to treat evolution and creation as alternatives, as both fundamentalists and atheists do, many atheists. Did this species of animal arise by natural processes, or because God wrote nature's script that way? Both. That's why the Catholic Church never condemned were opposed to evolution of species, the theory of evolution. This also makes clear why scientific materialists are wrong to think that believers in God do so without evidence. For materialists, evidence means either directly observing something with our senses or inferring that something exists as a natural cause of what we do observe. The way we observe a compass needle move and infer that there's a magnetic field. Obviously, God cannot be seen in either of these ways, for he is neither a part of nature, which could be sensed, nor a natural cause within the universe, which could be inferred scientifically in that way. And yet God is a cause, the ultimate cause. He is not a cause within nature. He is the cause of nature. Thus, nature gives evidence of God in the same way a play or novel gives evidence of its author, even if the author does not make an appearance within the book. So let me turn to the materialist historical critique of religion. The idea that Christianity, and the Catholic Church in particular, opposed science and tried to hold it back is called by historians of science the conflict thesis. It is not accepted nowadays by very many historians of science. It's largely discredited among experts. The idea that there were two warring camps, the scientific camp and the religious camp, is a complete anachronism. For most of the history of modern science, those two camps were the same camp. The scientists were religious people. The scientific revolution, which took place in the 17th century and gave rise to modern science, did not occur in opposition to revealed religion. In fact, most of the great figures were devout Christians. Copernicus, whose work sparked the scientific revolution, was an official of the Catholic Church. Johannes Kepler, famous for his three laws of planetary motion, was a devout Lutheran who at the end of his great work on the harmony of the world, wrote, "I thank thee, Lord God, our Creator, that thou hast allowed me to see the beauty in thy work of creation. Galileo remained a devout Catholic throughout his life. Descartes, whose work in mathematics was foundational for modern science, believed in God and the reality of the spiritual soul. Blaise Pascal was not only a mathematician and physicist of genius, but a man whose life was transformed by an intense mystical experience, and who wrote in defense of Christian belief against skepticism. Robert Boyle, the first modern chemist, often regarded as the founder of modern chemistry, left a large sum of money to endow a series of lectures whose purpose was to combat unbelief. And Isaac Newton, the greatest of them all, spent as much time on theological and scriptural studies as he did on science and mathematics. All of them saw their work as showing the beauty of God's creation, rather than as supporting atheism. And this was true long beyond the 17th century. For example, the two greatest physicists of the 19th century, Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell, were exceptionally devout Christians, even by the standards of their day. Moreover, the scientific revolution did not spring out of thin air. Its foundations were laid in the universities of medieval Europe, as has been strongly emphasized by the eminent historian of science, Edward Grant. It was in those European, largely Western, Central European universities that for the first time in human history, science was studied and taught on a continuous basis from generation to generation by a stable community of scholars. That is, where science was, as Edward Grant put it, first institutionalized. They produced hundreds of thousands of graduates who were introduced to scientific questions and from whose ranks scientific talent could emerge. The scientific community and scientific public these universities created were the soil in which the seeds of the scientific revolution germinated. Now, because the Catholic Church specifically is often accused of having been anti-science due to its treatment of Galileo, I'd like to focus for a few minutes on the Catholic Church's record with regard to science. A little-known fact that dramatically illustrates the positive role that the Catholic Church has played in the development of science is the large number of Catholic priests who made major discoveries or contributions to science. Now, we Catholics have our litany, so what I'm going to do now is not give you a litany of saints, but a litany of Catholic priest scientists. And I'm going to skip the Middle Ages for reasons of time. So I'm skipping all these interesting people. Nicholas Arem is especially interesting. He was a genius, actually. But I'm going to skip him. I'm going to skip all the way to the 17th century, the century of the scientific revolution. And here I'll tell you about five or six people, starting with Niels Stenson, also known as Steno. Steno was Danish by birth. He converted as an adult to Catholicism and became a priest, and eventually was made a bishop. He was noted for his asceticism and his solicitude for the poor, and was beatified by Pope John Paul II. Stenson, or Steno, was the greatest anatomist of his time, and several parts of the human body are named after him. He was especially made discoveries about the glandular lymphatic system. There's Stenson's duct, Stenson's veins, Stenson's foramina, whatever that is. So he's known in that area to this day. But his greatest contribution is, which he's considered a founder of the science of geology, was developing for the first time the correct theory of the origin of sedimentary rocks. Indeed, understanding for the first time that these rocks were originally underwater and formed by sedimentation, and the origin of fossils. His theories unlocked the history of the Earth. One reason we know how old the Earth is due to the work of Neil Stenson. That's a Google doodle. That on Stenson's birthday, at one point, Google celebrated his birth with a. Those are sediments and little fossils embedded in. Mersenne is considered the founder of acoustics for his fundamental discoveries in the theory of sound and vibrations. He also made contributions to the theory of reflecting telescopes and other contributions to science. He's probably even more important, however, for his role in developing the scientific community. In those days, before there were scientific conferences, before there were journals, conferences, internet, and so on. How did scientists learn about each other's work? Well, it was largely by correspondence, and Mersenne was a hub. He was a voluminous correspondent with other scientists and was an important means by which they learned about each other's work. He also helped found one of the first scientific societies in Europe. The Dictionary of Scientific Biography calls him one of the architects of the European scientific community. His religious house, his convent, became a meeting house of famous scientists. That's where Descartes first met Pascal, for example. I'm going to tell you about a few Jesuit scientists. Christoph Scheiner. The Jesuits have a great tradition in astronomical research, which continues to this day in the Vatican Observatory. The very calendar we use was developed by a Jesuit astronomer, Christoph Clavius, in the 1500s. Christoph Scheiner, who's shown here observing the sun, was one of the co-discoverers of the telescope of sunspots, and he made the most detailed studies of them. And here is a picture from his great treatise on sunspots, and he's following the sunspot on successive days as the sun spins, the sunspot travels across the face of the sun. Gian Battista Riccioli, another Jesuit astronomer of the 17th century, did a number of things. He developed and calibrated pendulum clocks for the precise measurement of time and used them to make the first precise measurement of the acceleration of gravity to study falling bodies. He did a number of things, and actually only about a few months ago, there was an article in Physics Today that pointed out something that was not known. How many have heard of the Coriolis effect or Coriolis forces? Turns out Coriolis wasn't the first to discover them. They were discovered by Riccioli, Gian Battista Riccioli. So he actually was the first person, and he described them and he did the Coriolis effect in great detail. He also did work on mapping the moon with the next person. The next Jesuit scientist, Francesco Grimaldi. Now, Grimaldi, I'll ask, how many people know what diffraction is? Diffraction is a very important phenomenon in physics. Diffraction was first discovered by Grimaldi in the 1600s. He's the one who called it diffraction. He did very careful measurements and very careful observations of the effect. I put on there some diffraction phenomena pictures I took from the internet. I think I'll skip over Benedetto Castelli, and I'll skip over Bonaventura Cavalieri, who was a priest who made him, actually he made important contributions that helped lead up to the integral calculus, and Leibniz himself, who along with Newton is regarded as the discoverer of calculus, paid tribute to Cavalieri and Torricelli. Who were both actually students of Benedetto Castelli, who was a priest. But I will skip that. One of the greatest biologists of the 18th century was Lazzaro Spallanzani. His contributions to biology were varied and numerous. Among many things he did, which I'm going to skip over, he did a series of experiments disproving the theory of spontaneous generation. And about 100 years later, when Louis Pasteur had to face the same issues, he did experiments that they built upon and were based upon the experiments of Spallanzani. But he was a very creative and productive scientist. Founder of crystallography, I'll skip over him. Giuseppe Piazzi, who was not a Jesuit, was an important astronomer, and he discovered the first asteroid. Series. And here on the upper, that's his Hubble Space Telescope picture. A couple of years ago, NASA spacecraft went in orbit around Ceres and took those lower pictures. Ceres actually was for many decades was considered the largest asteroid. It's been reclassified actually as a dwarf planet along with Pluto because it's large enough that its self-gravity makes it take the shape of a sphere. Angelo Secchi. All astrophysicists will have heard of Angelo Secchi. He is considered one of the founders of modern astrophysics for his pioneering use of spectroscopy in the study of stars and the sun. He made the first classification of stars based on their spectrum, and it's the basis of the classification that is still used today. So that's why astrophysicists, by the way, a very nice image, symbol of the harmony between faith and science is that he did some of his groundbreaking observations using a telescope which he had, an observatory which he had mounted on the roof of the Church of Sant'Ignazio in Rome. Beautiful church, I should say. If you are a mathematician, you know about Bernard Bolzano. You've heard of the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, the Bolzano function. He was one of the people who helped put modern mathematics on a rigorous foundation. And here's the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy says, he was an outstanding mathematician and possibly the greatest logician in the time between Leibniz and Frege. He was a Czech priest, I should say. Gregor Mendel, don't have to tell you who he is. If you're afraid to give a talk at Notre Dame, I have to mention Julius Newland, who's a professor at Notre Dame who helped develop the first synthetic rubber. And now, last but not least, is Father Georges Lemaître, who is considered the founder, the main principal founder of the Big Bang Theory, which is the central pillar of modern cosmology. So that's a glorious record of achievement. And that's just the priests. I haven't told you about the lay people. Professor Lawrence Principe of Johns Hopkins University, who's both a chemist and a noted historian of science, has written, "The Catholic Church has been probably the largest single and longest term patron of science in history." So the rest of my talk, I'm gonna leave it there, no more, that's the last picture I'm gonna show. I'm going to deal with the third strand, and I have, I guess, only about 15 minutes at most, so I may have to truncate this. The materialist critique, the idea that the great discoveries of modern science have debunked or undercut traditional Christian and Jewish view of the universe, of human beings, and of our place in the universe. So this is the scientific strand of the critique of religion. Now, as things stood 100 years ago, this view had some plausibility, but a lot has changed in the last 100 years. There have been several major discoveries or developments, especially in physics, that seem more consonant to the Christian and Jewish conception of the universe and of our place in it than with the materialists' view. I would like to discuss five of them, but I may not be able to do that in the remaining time. So in each case, I'll mention earlier discoveries that it seemed to favor the materialists' view, and then the more recent developments that point the other way, or seem to point the other way. The first has to do with the structure of the universe. We have all heard the story of how Copernicus overturned the religious conception of the picture of the cosmos by showing that we are not at the center of the universe, and how later discoveries demoted us even further by showing that Earth is just a tiny speck lost in the vastness of space. Actually, however, the idea of the Earth as being at the center of the universe did not come from the Bible, but from ancient Greek science, specifically Aristotle and Ptolemy. There was one idea about, actually the biblical idea, view of the universe was much more primitive than that. There was one idea about cosmology, however, that did enter Western thought from biblical revelation. It was not about space and whether it had a center. It was about time and whether it had a beginning. The pagan thinkers of antiquity, including Aristotle, conceived of the universe as having had no beginning. Modern atheists have also tended to prefer this idea. And until about 100 years ago, almost every indication from science seemed to support it. Physicists discovered that the amount of energy never changes. It cannot be created or destroyed. Chemists found that the number of atoms never changes in chemical reactions. In Newtonian physics, time extended infinitely into the past and future, just as space extended infinitely in all directions, or at least it was natural to conceive of it as doing so. Almost everything suggested that matter, energy, space, and time had always existed and always would. The idea of a beginning came to be seen as outdated religious mythology. The Nobel Prize-winning chemist Svante Arrhenius said in 1911, "The opinion that something can come from nothing is at variance with the present-day state of science, according to which matter is immutable." The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Walter Nernst declared, To deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundations of science. But in 1916, Einstein proposed his theory of gravity, general relativity, and everything changed. In the 1920s, the Belgian theoretical physicist, Georges Lemaître, who we met already, who was a Catholic priest also, realized that the equations of Einstein's theory of gravity could describe a universe whose space was expanding. He actually was the first to really understand that space can expand in Einstein's theory. Combining this with the observation by astronomers that distant galaxies were receding from us, Lemaître proposed what is now called the Big Bang Theory. It took a long while to gain acceptance, primarily for scientific reasons, but also partly because of philosophical prejudice against the idea of a beginning. But in time, the evidence grew overwhelming that the hypothesized Big Bang did in fact occur about 14 billion years ago. Now, in the standard Big Bang theory, everything began at that point, matter, space, and time itself. Now, it is possible that something preceded the Big Bang, and it wasn't the absolute beginning of the universe and of time, but only the beginning of some phase of the history of the universe. There are many speculative models like that. There are, however, very strong theoretical reasons to think that the universe did have an absolute beginning a finite time ago, if not at the Big Bang, then at some earlier point. So the weight of evidence seems to be in favor of a beginning. Science now strongly supports an idea that came historically from biblical revelation and was dismissed both by the pagans of antiquity and modern materialists, by and large, as contrary to science. The second development has to do with the evidence of design in nature. Religious belief is always in evidence of God's hand in the world, the starry heavens, the beautiful forms of living things, the other wonders of nature were seen as having been fashioned by the hand of God. Modern science seemed, however, to undercut this idea by showing that they were the result of mechanisms that depended upon a combination of impersonal laws and blind chance. Whereas Genesis spoke of God placing the sun and moon in the firmament, astrophysics shows that they condensed from swirling clouds of gas and dust under the attraction of gravitational forces. Darwin showed how the intricate structures of living things could arise from natural selection, operating upon random mutations. When Napoleon asked the physicist Laplace why God was never mentioned in his great treatise on celestial mechanics, Laplace famously replied that he had no need of that hypothesis. The laws of physics had displaced God. Now, this is a new way of looking at the laws of nature. From ancient times, it had been argued, as we've seen, that the lawfulness of nature, the very lawfulness of nature, pointed to a lawgiver, pointed to God. But now, it was being argued that the laws of nature in and of themselves sufficiently explain everything, and so you don't need God. And this does seem to make a certain amount of sense if one thinks about the shapes or patterns that we see in tangible objects, or systems, or collections of objects, such as crystals, or seashells, or sunflowers, or motions of heavenly bodies. Consider, for example, the solar system. It exhibits many striking mathematical patterns, some of which were known to the ancients, but some of which were discovered by Johannes Kepler 400 years ago. Kepler found that each planet follows an elliptical path, with its speed varying in such a way that the line from planet to sun sweeps out equal areas and equal times. He also discovered a simple algebraic relation between the period of the planet's orbit and its distance from the sun. All of these and many other beautiful mathematical patterns in the solar system can be explained by the laws of Newtonian physics. That's what Laplace succeeded in doing, and why he said he didn't need God. Does that mean, however, that the laws of Newtonian physics explain the existence of cosmic order? No, quite the reverse. For how did Newtonian physics explain the order seen in the solar system? It did so by appealing to a deeper mathematical order that holds throughout the whole universe. It showed that Kepler's three laws of planetary motion follow from Newton's more fundamental laws of mechanics and gravity. But Newton's laws describe an order far grander and more impressive than the laws of Kepler. There was more cosmic order to explain after Newton than before. And where did the greater order discovered by Newton come from? Well, Newton's law of gravity comes from a yet more fundamental law, namely Einstein's theory of gravity. And Einstein's theory of gravity is more splendid, more profound, more beautiful mathematically than the laws of Newton. And the process continues. It's believed by many that Einstein's laws of gravity in turn can be derived from yet more beautiful and profound laws, very likely those of superstructure. And as one goes deeper, what we've seen in the last 100 years is as you go deeper, the mathematical ideas become more sophisticated, more subtle, richer, deeper. Kepler's laws can be explained in a few minutes to a middle school student. To understand Newton's laws, however, you must really know calculus. To grasp Einstein's theory of gravity, you have to know about curved four-dimensional non-Euclidean space-time, differential geometry, things like that. The mathematical depths of superstring theory have not been fully understood after 30 years or more than 30 years of intensive study by many of the world's greatest minds. As you go deeper, the ideas become deeper. That's what the progress in physics, especially in the 20th century, has shown with greater and greater clarity. The deeper we probe into the hidden workings of the physical world, the richer, more intricate, and more magnificent the mathematical structure we find. And all of this has changed the context in which we think about design and nature. When the questions that scientists ask were simply about shapes and patterns seen in tangible things, however beautiful, it may have seemed naive to speak of them as fashioned by the hand of God. They could be accounted for by the laws of physics. But now that the deepest laws of physics themselves have been found to form a magnificent mathematical edifice of great beauty and harmony, the question of a cosmic designer has returned with greater force than ever. In 1931, the great mathematician and physicist Hermann Weyl gave a lecture here at Yale, as a matter of fact, a series of lectures, and in which he said the following. Many think, quote, many think that modern science is far removed from God. I find, on the contrary, that it is much more difficult today for the knowing person to approach God from history, from the spiritual side of the world, and from morals. For there we encounter the suffering and evil in the world, which it is difficult to bring into harmony with an all-merciful and almighty God. In this domain, we have evidently not yet succeeded in raising the veil with which our human nature covers the essence of things. But in our knowledge of physical nature, we have penetrated so far that we can obtain a vision of the flawless harmony which is in conformity with sublime reason. Unquote. Minucius Felix spoke of the providence, order, and law in the heavens and on earth. The deeper we have penetrated into the structure of the universe, the more order and law we have seen. So that the ancient argument for God from the order of nature has been strengthened, not weakened, by scientific progress. And the third, and I guess maybe the final thing I'll speak about, I'll skip the last two things, has to do with whether there's purpose in nature. It's easy to regard natural things as having purposes. For example, the sun seems to exist to provide the energy that plants need to grow, and the rain exists to provide the water needed for life. And from this, it's a short step to ascribing such purposes to the mind, God. And the pre-modern science of Aristotle was based on teleology, the idea that natural processes and entities are directed toward ends or goals. Heavy objects fall in order to reach their proper place, which is the center of the earth. Living things heal from injury in order to reach the goal of bodily health and wholeness. But this teleological approach to science was set aside by the scientific revolution, especially in physics, and replaced by a mechanistic approach. Events were no longer seen as drawn toward future goals, but as driven blindly along by past and present causes. Modern physics explains how the sun formed and generates energy without reference to ends. In the perspective of modern physics, neither the sun nor its energy are for anything, such as supporting life on Earth. Rather, life on Earth takes advantage of the energy that happens to be there. Darwinian evolution has pushed this mode of explanation further. To put it simply, trees do not exist so that monkeys can climb them, but rather some creatures adapted to the presence of trees by evolving the ability to climb. But the idea of purpose in nature has staged a revival. And again, it is not so much at the level of tangible things, trees, monkeys, but at the level of the laws of physics themselves. Over the last 40 years or so, physicists have become increasingly aware that many features of the laws of physics seem arranged just so as to make life possible. These are sometimes called anthropic coincidences, which is not a very good name for them, but there it is. Now, one could give many examples. I'll just mention a few. If the world did not obey the principles of quantum mechanics, atoms and molecules would not be the stable building blocks with well-defined properties out of which you could build complex, stable structures, such as living things. If the down quark, so-called down quark, were lighter than the so-called up quark, instead of heavier, then ordinary hydrogen, on which all life depends, would be radioactively unstable. If the so-called strong force, which holds nuclei together, were even a fraction weaker than it is, a crucial nucleus called deuterium could not exist, and the nuclear reactions that power the sun and similar stars would not be able to take place, depriving the Earth of the energy needed for life. Moreover, the fusion processes that occur in stars, and which were required to form all the elements of the periodic table besides hydrogen, would not have been possible. Another example is the fact that we live in a universe with three large or macroscopic spatial dimensions. If the number of macroscopic spatial dimensions were greater than three, gravity would act differently, and it would not be possible for planets to orbit stars stably. They would either plunge into the stars or fly off into space. Atoms would also be unstable. I can go on and on giving examples of such features of the laws of physics that are, if they were different, or sometimes even if they were very slightly different, would make it impossible for life as we know it to arise. Now, there's a way of explaining this naturalistically, which is very interesting, and I think possibly partly correct, but it may explain some of these, called the multiverse idea, which we could talk about in the Q&A. But prima facie, one thing we have learned is that we shouldn't take it for granted that the universe is life. The laws of physics have to be very special, or you're not going to have a universe with life in it. And so that is possibly suggestive of purpose in this design of the universe and its laws. I should mention, and this may be where I'll stop, the vast size of the universe, which some people take as evidence of our insignificance and of the sort of meaninglessness of it, the fact that the universe is so enormous compared to human scales, both in time and in space, is actually one of the things that makes life possible in our universe. The astrophysical and biological processes by which life arose required billions of years to unfold. And according to Einstein's theory of gravity, a universe which lasts for billions of years must attain a size of at least billions of light years across. A universe that never got larger than a more comfortable human scale, let's say the universe never got larger than North America. Maybe that was the size that the ancient Hebrews thought it was. It never got bigger than thousands of miles. It would have lasted a tiny fraction of a second. The universe would have lasted. Even a universe the size of the solar system would have only lasted for a matter of days. Weeks, I suppose. The fourth development, I'd like to talk about some of the implications of quantum mechanics, but I'm going to that one. Take me another 15 minutes. I'm going to stop right there. Quantum mechanics arguably, well, first of all, has two implications that I think are very important philosophically. First, determinism, which was, until the quantum mechanics showed up, all the evidence was that the laws of physics were deterministic. That the state of the world at some past time uniquely determined its development for all future time, which seemed inconsistent with human free will. Actually, that determinism of classical physics was a major blow to religious belief. It actually did far more damage to religious belief in the West than any, probably the theory of evolution did for some people. But determinism was overthrown by quantum mechanics. Another implication of quantum mechanics is that arguably, and this is an argument that goes back to John von Neumann, to people like Eugene Wigner, Rudolf Peierls, and a number of great physicists have made this argument, that quantum mechanics is inconsistent with physicalism. That if you insist that everything is physical, everything is described by the laws of physics, that you run into hopeless conundrums in understanding quantum mechanics, and particularly run into something called a measurement problem. Becomes essentially insuperable difficulty. So I'll stop there, and I guess my punchline is that I hope that I've shown that Christianity and the Catholic Church in particular has been a friend of modern science and has nothing to fear from modern science, and that the real antagonist of religion is not science, but scientific materialism, which is a reductive philosophy. It comes from a blinkered view of reality and actually a blinkered view of science itself. Thank you.